Ezekiel chapter 40. I invite you to join me there. We're actually going to be wrapping up our series here in Ezekiel today and then launching into our Advent series next Sunday. Today, Ezekiel chapter 40. This is probably a familiar image for many of you. Hopefully, you are familiar with J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, alongside of The Hobbit. Tremendous works of literature conveying powerful themes as it relates to the gospel. The Return of the King is the final installment of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. The evil Sauron sends a great army against Minas Tirith, the capital city of Gondor, the greatest city of Middle-earth, and all seems lost. And everyone is waiting for Aragorn to arrive. If only Aragorn could arrive, the city could be saved, Middle-earth could be preserved. Similar scene is painted in The Last Battle, C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. It's a very dark time in Narnia. There's a lot of confusion about Aslan, the great lion. Dark forces have entered. The talking beasts have been silenced. The trees are being cut down. Again, it seems that all is lost. Tyrion, the last king of Narnia, is powerless to reverse the course of the evil. It is only when Aslan arrives that there is any hope, right? So these themes, I think, just help us think about what Ezekiel is going to be talking about here in Ezekiel 40 through 43, what I'm calling the return of the king. And it's focused on God's presence among his people. And we all long for the new heaven and the new earth. We long for the eradication of cancer and COVID and conflict. Scripture stirs our imagination. It paints a wonderful picture of what it is to live in a world without sickness and death. So we ought to think about those things. But at the heart of all of that is the presence of God himself. That's what makes the new earth and the new heavens so great. It's God's very presence among his people. Coming into the holidays, and we think about what it is sometimes to become more enamored with the gift than the giver. You know, to kind of focus on the things and forget the one who has blessed us with the things. And Ezekiel's drawing the people back to their great hope in God himself in a restored relationship. So first of all, the outline's going to look a little different today. I'm just tracing through the story and the points there. Some texts don't lend themselves to an outline. Warren Wiersbe always used to say, make sure you don't outline the life out of a text. Try to cram it into a box. So I'm just simply going to trace the narrative, and then we will provide some takeaways here at the end. The first section I've just labeled "When All Seems Lost." It's a bleak scene here in Ezekiel chapter 40. Ezekiel 40, verse 1. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, on that very day, the hand of the Lord was on me, and he took me there. In visions of God, he took me to the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain, on whose south side were some buildings that looked like a city. He took me there, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. He was standing in the gateway with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. The man said to me, "Son of man, look carefully and listen closely and pay attention to everything I am going to show you, for that is why you have been brought here. Tell the people of Israel everything you see." So you'll remember that Ezekiel was in exile, displaced from his homeland, a refugee, and he was living among a larger group of exiles in Babylon. It was a dark time, and we're reminded of the fact that This exile did not last for a few days or a few months or even a few years. They had been in exile at this point for 25 years. Restricted, right? Under the thumb of foreign oppressors. I mean, it kind of puts a nine-month COVID restriction situation in perspective, doesn't it? This is exile, 25 years of COVID, right? What is the significance of the 25 years? Why does God sort of break in now at this particular juncture? We can't say for sure, but I think we have some pretty good, the text sort of guides us in some ways of thinking here. First of all, it was a reminder of the settled and seemingly hopeless state of their predicament. These people had been brought to the end of themselves, the end of their own resources, the end of their own ingenuity. It certainly surfaces there in the vision of the dry bones in chapter 37, right? The people of Israel, the nation of Israel, are like the dry bones, and they even cry out, right? We are dry bones. Our hope is lost. We have been cut off, separated. And that was their complaint. That was their lament. They had been brought to that point. And it's in that context God had them right where he wanted them, right? They were left only to look to God and his grace and his providence and his mercy. So I think that's part of why there was this long delay. It also was a day of Jewish nationalism. We are told here at the outset of chapter 40 that this all happened at the beginning of the year. The beginning of the year. And this could be a reference to the Day of Atonement, which was the beginning of the civic calendar in Israel for the Jewish people. It could be a reference to Passover, which was the beginning of the religious or spiritual calendar for the people of Israel. But in any regard, it seems as if this was happening at a time when the people were gathered together during a season of remembrance. Their hearts were oriented towards God's promises. Their hearts were oriented towards Israel. It's kind of like this season when maybe you're not able to be with... We had big plans to be out in New Jersey with Sherry's grandfather, who's 104. And we've been planning this trip to get out there and spend time with him. And of course, that's not going to be a reality. A lot of different factors that have weighed into that. But our heart's kind of there right now. We're thinking about that right now, right? And this is a season of national celebration for Israel, where their hearts are stirred with where they're at. You know, they're celebrating Passover, but it's not where they want to be celebrating it. So this too could have been part of what was going on here. And then the 25th year of their exile would have also been the year of Ezekiel's 50th birthday. Now you have to go back and construct the math and go back to chapter 1 and kind of piece all that together again. We were reminded that Ezekiel God appeared to Ezekiel on his 30th birthday, which was the first year that someone could serve as a priest. So he's commissioned as a priest, probably thinking he was never going to serve as a priest, right? He wasn't even in the land. They had no access to the temple. But God tabs him for a special priestly ministry to speak to the people on his behalf. And of course, there at the outset of his priestly ministry, he told them about God's unfolding judgment. But here, perhaps as his last priestly task, priest would have to retire at the age of 50. Priestly work was very physically demanding work. So you retired at 50 and you would then move into a mentoring role with younger priests. So perhaps as Ezekiel's last priestly act, he is to convey to the people a message of tremendous hope, a message of restoration to the land. So all of this is sort of packed into the emotion of the text. When all seems lost, God speaks into that. And we're told here as well in these opening verses that he was given a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. And these are not implements that we're familiar with, but if this maybe just helps you with the visual, he was given a tape measure, right, to go about and measure all that he saw And the idea was, I want you to pay very careful attention, he's told, so that you can go back and relay this vision accurately and in all of its fullness and in all of its grandeur. So he says, I want you to measure it. It's a way of locking in what he was going to see. Well, we move from the time when all seemed lost to a stirring sight. There's a shift that happens here. He sees something that is truly amazing. Ezekiel 40, verse 5. I saw a wall completely surrounding the temple area. The length of the measuring rod in the man's hand was 6 long cubits, each of which was a cubit and a handbreadth. He measured the wall. It was 1 measuring rod thick and 1 rod high. Then he went to the east gate. He climbed its steps and measured the threshold of the gate. It was 1 rod deep. The alcoves for the guards were 1 rod long and 1 rod wide, and the projecting walls between the alcoves were 5 cubits thick. And the threshold of the gate next to the portico facing the temple was 1 rod deep. Then he measured the portico of the gateway. It was 8 cubits deep, and its jambs were 2 cubits thick. The portico of the gateway faced the temple. Inside the east gate were 3 alcoves on each side. The 3 had the same measurements. Are you getting the picture here? Are your eyes glossing over yet? Right? This goes on for 3 chapters. All these little minute measurements describing this great scene. And essentially this scene was a restored temple. So not only was he seeing a city, but he's actually brought down into this temple complex. And he measures the wall around the outside of the complex. He measures its width and its height and all of the different storage rooms that were around the perimeter. He measures those entrances that led into the great courtyard there, the temple courts. And then the entrances that led from the outer courts to the inner court, where you see the altar there as the central feature. And then the temple proper, where the Holy of Holies would have been, and the Ark of the Covenant would have been kept, and God would presence himself there in that place. So this was the scene that was laid out before him, the scene that he was to measure and to take in and to carefully observe. What does the temple represent? What does this scene mean? This has puzzled scholars for a long time. The dimensions of this temple do not correspond with any known temple construct there in Jerusalem. The dimensions are far too big for Solomon's temple, the original temple that he helped to construct. The dimensions certainly are bigger than what's called the second temple that was constructed by the exiles when they came back from the land. That temple was later expanded by King Herod, but it was never expanded to these proportions. So either Ezekiel is describing a far greater temple that would be built in the future, perhaps in the millennial kingdom, or he is describing with symbolic language just this wonderful future reality in which the people would once again have peace with God in his temple. In any regard, this scene would have been a great encouragement to God's people who were living separated from God, separated from the land. They would realize there was a future for them. Israel was going to be restored. Jerusalem was going to be rebuilt. The temple was going to be built, and it was going to be built in a grand scale. And it was going to be perfect in its beauty and its symmetry. It represented not only their restoration to the land, but more importantly, a restoration of relationship with God. We talked about this earlier in Ezekiel when we talked about the temple. The temple was meant to be an echo of the Garden of Eden. The temple had so much imagery in it that was to remind them of the garden. Matter of fact, you see it first introduced here in Ezekiel 40 in verse 16. Here it makes reference to the decorations of palm trees. And that just is repeated again and again and again. Palm trees and cherubs or angels. Again, these are distinctive features from the Garden of Eden. So the people had been, Adam and Eve, were put out of the garden, right? Separated from God's presence, cut off from accessing the tree of life. And in a sense, the whole story of human history is an attempt to get back to the garden. It's an attempt to get back to the presence of God. The temple represented that. Palm trees everywhere you looked. And Jerusalem's kind of at a high point. It's rather arid. Here's this oasis here in the middle of the desert, meant to remind them of this place of perfect fellowship with God. So it's a beautiful scene that was laid out here. And then there's what I'm calling the triumphant moment. So we have a couple of chapters here, just all the minutiae of the measurements, starting with the outer wall, working through the entrances and into the inner courtyard and ultimately into the temple itself. He unpacks all of it, measures all of it. And then we kind of get the payoff here in chapter 43. Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of the God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory. So he's taken to the east gate of that temple complex, and he's standing there in the archway of this gate, and he looks out to the east, and he sees the glory of God coming. Now, where was God's glory? Why was it coming from the east? Well, I would suggest to you it's coming from the east because God's presence had been with his people in Babylon. And Ezekiel actually helps us connect the dots here. Notice verse 3, chapter 43, verse 3. The vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the Kabar River. And I fell face down. So he said, what I was seeing here as I looked out the east gate and saw God's glory approaching, what I was seeing was the same thing I saw earlier when God destroyed the city of Jerusalem and left the temple. Ezekiel chapter 10. And it's the same vision I saw back at the Kabar River, recorded in Ezekiel chapter 1. They're in exile. He saw the four living creatures, right, with four faces, and they were together holding up a vast platform with a throne on which sat the manifestation of God. And around each of the four living creatures was a wheel within a wheel, so that this royal chariot could move in any direction without turning, like bursts of lightning. An impressive war machine, unlike anything that had ever been seen. So Ezekiel says, that's what I was seeing. God's presence had left the temple previously. God's presence had come to his people in Babylon. And now I'm seeing God's presence, his royal chariot, return to Jerusalem. And not only did it come into the temple complex, but Ezekiel is quite specific. He watched it enter into the Holy of Holies in the temple itself. Verse 4, the glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Here is the return of the king. And then God spoke from the Holy of Holies. Verse 6. While the man was standing beside me, I heard someone speaking to me from inside the temple. He said, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place for the soles of my feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. The people of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings at their death. When they placed their threshold next to my threshold and their doorposts beside my doorposts, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So I destroyed them in my anger. Now let them put away from me their prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings, and I will live among them forever. So God promises to establish his permanent presence. This wasn't going to be just a temporary thing. He's saying, I am going to establish my, no more leaving, establish my permanent presence with my people. But part of what's going to be involved there is that my people are going to have to be purified. They're going to have to be decontaminated, right? And he outlines his plan to not only return, but to cleanse the people in such a way that they will be able to live in his presence. He touches on a couple of the sins of the people here. Talks about first in verse 7 there, about their prostitution. Neither they nor their kings by their prostitution. And I don't think he's speaking here of sexual ethics specifically. I think he's saying that he had drawn Israel into a covenant relationship with him. He had married Israel. He had taken Israel as his wife, an exclusive relationship. And Israel had persistently been unfaithful, had engaged in infidelity, had worshipped other gods and goddesses, had formed alliances and allegiances with the various nations around them. And so he calls them out for their prostitution, their unfaithfulness. And then he makes a very interesting reference there in verse 7, the prostitution and the funeral offerings for their kings at their death. This is a very tricky phrase here. Matter of fact, all three of the most prominent words in that phrase are a bit unclear for translators. So you see, it comes across very differently in your various English translation. The ESV says, the dead bodies of their kings at their high places. The NIV here, funeral offerings for their kings at their death. So what is going on here? Some have suggested that some of the kings of Israel were buried in royal tombs in proximity to the temple and in that way defiled the temple. Some have said that this had more to do with some kind of veneration that had grown up around Israel's deceased kings, that there was some occult activity that was going on here. I think the NIV, the 84 version, probably gets it closest when it says, speaks of the lifeless idols of their kings at their high places. So the deadness is not the bodies of the kings, but the deadness is the dead idols, the lifeless idols that they had established here at the high places, in the temple courts. Manasseh was one of the kings who was most notorious for this. He set up an Asherah pole, a vulgar image, right there in the temple courts. He constructed shrines for the worship of the stars right there in the temple courts. And I think verse 8 provides the context for us here. So these funeral offerings for their kings at their death, The lifeless idols that the kings erected, verse 8, when they placed their threshold next to my threshold and their doorposts beside my doorposts, with only a wall between me and them, they defiled my holy name by their detestable practices. So God says, I'm gonna purge all of these aberrant worship practices and all the things that have been characterizing the temple. I'm going to purge it all and claim it again as my abode, the place where I will establish my presence. Well, what does all this mean for the people? These final three verses sort of give us the takeaway. 43, verse 10. Son of man, describe the temple to the people of Israel that they may be ashamed of their sins. Let them consider its perfection. And if they are ashamed of all they have done, make known to them the design of the temple, its arrangement, its exits and entrances, its whole design, and all its regulations and laws. Write these down before them so that they may be faithful to its design and follow all its regulations. This is the law of the temple. All the surrounding area on top of the mountain will be most holy. Such is the law of the temple. So the law of the temple, there's like a principle that's sort of driven home here at the end. Well, how are the exiles supposed to react or respond to this scene, this gloriously rebuilt, restored temple? They were to be very aware of their own sin. They considered the beauty, the grand scale of this temple, its symmetry, its perfections. They were to be mindful of the fact that they were not perfect. They were to be reminded of the chaos of their own hearts as they considered the perfection of God in his temple. This idea of the law of the temple. The law of the temple is that no one approaches God without first dealing with their sin. So it's this profound message of God's holiness. They were reminded, even by the altar, there is the central feature that no one can approach God without the atonement for sin. So this was to be the impact. It would certainly encourage them that God was going to restore his people to the land, restore his temple, but it would also sober them to think about their sin and its devastating consequences. So what are the enduring lessons for God's people? Quickly, God does not forget about his people. I love this. 25 years goes by, all seems lost, our bones are dry, our hope is gone, we've been cut off. Ezekiel 37, but God had not forgotten his promise to restore his people to the land. Abraham was childless, right, at the age of 100, but God did not forget his promise to give him an heir, to make of him a great nation. Israel spent 400 years in slavery in Egypt, but God did not forget his promise to bring them into a promised land. After being anointed by Samuel, David spent the next number of years on the run from King Saul. He must have wondered if God had forgotten about him, but God had not forgotten about him. And in his own good time, he brought David to the throne. No matter how many years go by, no matter how dire the circumstances, God does not forget his covenant promises. We get a wonderful reminder here of that truth. Secondly, God's way is best. God's way is best. Adam and Eve thought God was holding out on them, right? They wanted something more than what God had provided, and that didn't go so well, right? The people of Israel here, they pursued the worship of other gods. They engaged in the detestable practices of the nations around them, thinking those would make them happy, those would bring them greater wealth and prosperity, and they were sorely disappointed. Right? The prodigal son, who thinks, if I could only get out of my father's house, I would be happy and fulfilled. And he was happy for about a month. And then he was miserable and he realized how good he had it in his father's house. We're reminded again here, Israel is reminded again, we are reminded again that the beauty and perfection of this future temple stands in stark contrast to the disorder and chaos of life as we know it. This temple represents life at its best. Life in the garden. Life as it was meant to be lived. Life lived according to God's guidelines and parameters. Number three, we can only approach God on God's terms. This was driven home to the people. This picture here of perfection should remind us all of our sin. And it should remind us of how we are to approach God through the atoning sacrifices centered on the altar. If we were to read all those measurements, right, in Ezekiel and moving from the outer courts and the walls inward, spends a lot of time on the altar as the central feature before one can enter into the presence of God. And then that's reiterated here in what's called the law of the temple, the law of God's holiness. God cannot tolerate sin. Our sin must be addressed. And it points us ahead to the redeeming, atoning work of Christ. A perfect human sacrifice has now been offered to atone for human sins. God is preparing a beautiful future for his people, centered on the return of the King. Are you going to be part of that great future? Have you approached God in a way to have your sins atoned for? Are you walking in his ways? Be able to participate in this great and joyful future.